It's Saturday, February 25th, 2006, 10:06 a.m. on the central coast of California. Today's rundown, a bit of geek news, and then Google Maps hacks, tips and tools for geographic searching and remixing with the authors Rich Gibson.
Geek Speak is a production of KUSP, Central Coast Public Radio, kusp.org. The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com.
It's time now for Geek Speak.
We're through being cool. We're through being cool. Eliminate the ninnies and the twits.
Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today on our program, we'll focus on, of course, geek news, and then we're going to talk about Web 2.0 stuff, the new stuff in the web, which is a lot of client-side, a lot of really fast web applications, and some information, some access to some amazing information. And we have author Rich Gibson, and possibly Scott, his co-author, Skylar Earle, of Google Maps Hacks, Tips and Tools for Geographic Searching and Remixing. We're going to talk about the interface to Google Maps, which has a great, one of the greatest things about Google Maps when I first saw it is that it has a satellite click as well. So you can do a normal map kind of thing, and then you can click over the satellite and see what it looks like from, well, theoretically space. So that's in about 15 minutes. And of course, during the second half of the show, we'll welcome you to join our calls and to join our conversation. We'll also be giving out two books today. So take down these phone numbers. 476-2800 or toll free at 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can go to geekspeak.org and click on contact us. I'll give it that contact information when I invite your participation in about a half an hour. This program is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts, as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 SoCal Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. This is Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are geeks, Drew Meyer, product manager at Network Appliance, and John Tracy, technical support engineer at Surf Control. Drew and John, welcome to Geek Speak.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Before we get on topic today with Google Maps hacks, let's talk about some geek news. John.
This week, if you've got an Apple computer, it's now horribly infected and riddled with viruses. You should probably just throw it away. I'm afraid it's doom and destruction.
You know, for years on Geek Speak, we've been talking about how don't worry about viruses on Mac. I mean, one day it will hit, and just make sure you pay attention to Geek Speak because we'll tell you if there's viruses on a Macintosh. And
well, it happened in between shows, so I'm afraid we're all doomed.
Oh, man.
There were three. I'm just kidding, of course. If you have an Apple computer, chances are you're perfectly virus-free unless you've been clicking a lot of random attachments, in which case you get what you deserve.
Okay, so the first
same
one
as
happened
with any other computer.
The first one happened on like Wednesday, I think.
Yeah, and it was called Leap A, also called Oompa Loompa. And it's
Can we use the term Oompa Loompa?
Sure. The Oompa Loompa virus.
Sounds frightening.
If you click files, it will happen to you.
John, you're in the virus industry. How do they name viruses?
You know what? I actually don't know how they name viruses. Right. And it's odd because each virus company, antivirus company, has its own naming convention. So when a virus comes out, you will see four different names. And you're like, oh my God, we're being infected by four different viruses. Uh-huh. It's all the same virus. Everyone has their own name.
Got it.
The Oompa Loompa virus uses an exploit in iChat, which uses the bonjour, formerly known as rendezvous.
Hello, hello.
Technology, which is basically their iChat technology. Allows you to connect to remote resources and like printers, things like that.
Yeah, and also it allows you to do chatting and sending messages to each other.
Right.
Or files.
Exactly. Which is where this comes through. If you send an image file compressed as a TAR, a TGZ, I guess it's loosely based
on TAR. It's a compression.
Yeah, file. You could, okay, to get this worm, it's not really a worm, it's a virus. To get this worm, someone would have to send it to you. You know, purposely forward this file to you. You would have to receive the file. You would have to double-click the file to launch the file. It would ask to install, therefore requiring you to put in your administrative password for the computer. You'd have to put that password in, and then it could infect your machine. Okay. And what and it would try to do is then send itself onto the next person to repeat the process.
Through iChat.
So
okay, so to some degree, it's a worm in that it automatically, if it actually runs, it automatically sends a copy to somebody else. But yeah. It's not very, it's just a Trojan in some sense because you still have to run the application.
You have to accept it, you have to run it and install it using the administrator password. So it's not really hard to
get
this. I remember
earlier in the week, Miles told me about it and I kind of stressed for a minute and then went, oh, this is nothing.
Yeah.
So basically what happened then?
The next one was called the Inqtana, INQTANA.A. It spreads via Bluetooth.
Really?
Yeah.
So my phone can get a virus or my headset.
You have to be running Panther 10.3 or Tiger, which is 10.4, and you have to have not updated it within the last year.
Okay.
This is an exploit Apple knew about a year ago and released a patch for. So if you use Bluetooth with other laptop computers, Apple computers, patch your computer.
Did it have any other vectors to copy itself, or is it just through Bluetooth? But in any case, the important thing about this is that it actually did take advantage of a bug in the software that was, you know, had a patch out a year ago, but, you know, if people don't patch, then there it is.
I think it's interesting these are all coming on the heels of the dual-core Intel Max being released.
But they won't run on those.
They're not specific toward the dual-core. You know, they will run on any Mac.
And the third virus? So that one is real simple.
The third
update
one was
your machine.
Virus. The third one was a web exploit in Safari.
That's right.
Where they could, you could
click on attachment and
click on a zip
it.
File. They were considered safe attachments, like a zip or a PDF.
Yeah.
If you click on it, if you double click, you know, download it, double click it, it could then potentially launch a Trojan or launch something.
But there wasn't a specific virus that did this. This is just an exploit.
It's
that
an exploit.
Note of.
It's similar to the WMV. The exploit in Windows that was out recently.
Okay, so general, make sure you have virus protection software on a Macintosh computer. Update your computer. Update virus protection software.
Any recommendations for Mac virus software? I don't have any yet.
We use Sophos up at the university.
Yeah, Sophos is great. I don't know if they have an individual user desktop one. I know you can get desktop scanners from them, but I don't know if they have individual one.
And the other way to go is don't use Safari on the Mac. Use Firefox. Because it doesn't have the exploit. Or you can go into the preferences and say don't auto-launch safe files.
Right.
Because it's right now it thinks that it's a safe file even though it's not. Okay, I want to get on some more news.
One more thing I'd like to say. Do get antivirus software. These three are not really bad exploits. They're really hard to get. But get antivirus software. It's kind of showing, yes, it's coming down the road. So don't feel too smug yet. Get ready.
Okay.
Be prepared, says John the Boy Scout. All right. And the man who should know. So Wi-Fi, that's the wrong website. Sorry, everybody. TIA. This is pretty fascinating. The Defense Department's Total Information Awareness Program is a controversial counterterrorism program which lawmakers halted more than 2 years ago. Turns out that it's transferred ownership and is still continuing to run under the National Security Agency, according to some documents that were just released. This thing is a massive information collection and parsing or crunching system designed by the Defense Department after 9/11, and doesn't ask you whether or not you're going to be included. It just goes ahead and steamrolls everybody and includes them. So there's more information in this article than I have time for. But really, essentially, if you're interested in security and interested in national security and what the government's the big brother approach, Google TIA. That's the critical piece of information. The Defense Department's Total Information Awareness Program. And it's now codenamed Basketball. It's been codenamed Top Sail. It's been codenamed Genoa 2. You know, these guys and spooks in the White House love to, they're code names just like us tech guys. And check it out. It's still running, still taking information about all of us and still archiving it away in government vaults, just like Indiana Jones.
I'm scared and amused at the same time.
It's amazing what we don't know goes on, and then these leaks happen, and suddenly, for the last 2 years, the government's been collecting everything.
Yeah, that's not good.
Your address, your phone numbers, your phone calls, everything.
All right, you want to do one more news story before we invite our guest on for today, John?
Okay, one that's mildly related. NASA's MRO is getting near Mars. MRO is the Mars Reconnaissance Observer. It's going to be able to take pictures of the planet. It's going to basically map the planet at 10 times the detail that we have now. So
our planet or Mars?
Mars.
Oh, okay.
That's why it's called the Mars Reconnaissance.
Sorry.
Okay. It's going to be aerobraking around Mars on the 10th of March. So it'll either be a successful aerobrake or we'll have a very fast landing on the planet. or we'll be lost in space. We'll see what happens.
Oh, come on. They're not going to make that mistake again.
But hopefully we'll be seeing a Google Mars coming out soon.
Oh, really?
You know, maybe. We'll hope.
There is currently a Google Moon.
You zoom in and zoom in and it's cheesy. Yeah, right.
You zoom in all the way and it's a big lump.
Yeah, it's pretty funny.
That's funny.
Also, on the moon, there's only like two mentions, you know, landing points.
There's like five landing points.
But I want to mention something about the Mars projects, and now I'm totally blanked on what it was, but earlier I said there was space news.
One of the cool...
Oh, they found the probe that they lost.
The Beagle?
The Beagle. They found its location. And it's surprisingly intact.
So they're going to go down and fix it now.
I don't think they're going to do that. All right. Well, thank you, John and Drew. Of course, you're staying with us as we talk about Google Maps hacks, which we're doing now. Rich Gibson is a Perl and database programmer in Santa Rosa. He has worked professionally with computers since 1982 when he created public utility rate case models in SuperCal on an Osborne 2. While the technology has changed, his fascination with using his finger muscle power to control electrical impulses has not. His current fascination is creating tools to aid in the acquisition, management, and presentation of information with, get this, geographic components. So he's currently converting an old golf cart into a mobile geo-annotation platform, which, of course, we've got to start the conversation with. Rich, thank you very much for joining us today on GeekSpeak.
Thank you.
So Rich, the golf cart drives around and tells you where you are?
Sure. The golf cart drives around and tells you where you are. Well, or should.
If it ran.
Uh-huh. If the last time it ran, one of the batteries hadn't caught on fire.
Oh. Man, that's the thing about making stuff. Sometimes it catches on fire.
Yeah.
Well. So let's talk about your book, Google Map Hacks. You wrote Rich Gibson. You are Rich Gibson. And also the other author is Skylar Earle, who we're not on with today, but we were expecting. In any case, Rich, I'm hoping that you can cover for us and explain your book fairly well. Let's start out by talking about what... from a user's perspective, when Google Maps launched, it was unique in the sense that it didn't do a lot of page reloads. Can you tell us about that kind of ingenuity?
Sure. That what Google Maps did is pre-cached maps, tiles of the whole world for varying resolutions. And as you scroll through a map, it will load the tiles that it thinks you're going to need next automatically in the background using that XML HTTP request object. So the effect to the user was you could scroll infinitely without, if you did it slow enough, without a page reload.
Meaning, when scrolling, you mean like grab the map and move it to the right or left and kind of keep doing that?
Right.
For the entire planet?
Yeah, for the entire planet, which is pretty amazing. So you can, for example, people do this, zoom into this to your house where when you're about to do a road trip and scroll along your whole path across the country or wherever, looking at the aerial photos like you mentioned or on the map view, and see things that you won't see when you're driving.
And this type of technology in a web page has been kind of coined Web 2.0. What's the technology behind it that's made it possible?
Well, Web 2.0 is, one particular buzzword, as it were, that I happen to have drank the Kool-Aid, but there's some people who are vehemently anti-Web 2.0 as an idea. But it's really, in this case, we're talking about what has also been called AJAX, which is just a quasi-acronym for asynchronous JavaScript, XML, HTTP request. Just this whole having the browser be smarter,
right.
Having smarter applications in the browser. Gmail is probably the quintessential example of that, though no longer the leading one.
And we've had the people, makers of Backpack, on. So we've talked a little bit about this before. The basic idea with AJAX, and all this is fueled by a little JavaScript component that's built into browsers called the HTTP request object. And basically, the web page itself can keep talking to the web server without reloading the page, and it talks to you in the background, gets data, and then presents that data to you so that it feels more like a traditional application that you'd run on your desktop. For example, being able to scroll a map or being able to see new mail messages come up or open a mail message without actually doing that whole ask for everything, including like the images on the page, and it definitely has a faster, snappier feel. And, you know, since you've said it, and I'll say it as well, I drank the Kool-Aid on this as well. I really like the technology. So Google Map Hacks, though, when it first came out, was one of those ones that just took a great advantage of this, because you can't load all the maps of Earth. You did some calculations in your book. What, how big is the repository of images that Google has to do this?
That was actually, I'd have to look it up, I'm sorry. That's a hack that Skylar tracked down that some other people had done the math on, and basically it's huge.
Terabytes, right?
Yeah.
It's 3 terabytes, I think, something like that.
Which is actually, jumping ahead, it actually, it's terabytes and terabytes of data, and it's not, for all the coolness of it, it's not actually all that interesting in cartographic terms. When you look at all of that data, it doesn't let you do all kinds of things that you also want to do. And I don't know what you specifically want to do, but you might care about, you know, butterfly populations in Central California.
I do care about butterfly populations.
You know, or watersheds, or historical sites, or
Are you saying all this information is in Google Maps?
No, it's not.
Uh-huh.
It's not. So what's sort of interesting is how big Google Maps is in terms of storage requirements, and yet how much of what we know about the world isn't contained in it. So to move towards a view where we can comprehensively display the world or map the world, it's going to take even more data than sort of the fantastic resources that have already been put at it.
And it would be merging Google Maps with all the GIS data that exists.
Sure, sure. And there's,
and that's what your book's about, really, taking this great interface and adding to it. So
it is.
You said, so what kind of stuff do you, I mean, it seems to be that you're very interested in, what is the realm of map making or map studying? What is that called?
Cartography.
Cartography, thank you. So you're a cartographer. I mean, that's an interest of yours.
No, I'm not. I'm...
You're a hacker.
I'm a hacker who's come to maps, actually from story, because, you know, sort of in my worldview, maps tell stories. And we create these maps as it were, cultural artifacts that reflect what our view of the world is, either consciously or unconsciously. And that's pretty fascinating to me.
Okay.
So it's not just, you know, here's a Google map and here are all the roads and this is a depiction of the world, because in reality it's not. It's a depiction of the world is mediated through Google's view, is mediated then, of course, through their data providers. And then it goes all the way down to, basically, at a pretty basic level, to Lewis and Clark's journey of discovery, is we look at all of these things from Lewis and Clark's point of view.
Mm-hmm.
The standard meridians, the range township land system, and all of these things about how our maps are just, you know, 200 years old or more. They're all convention.
Let's talk about this newest type of way of dealing with maps and Google Maps. Can you give us some I mean, basically, it's maps.google.com, if you want to take a peek at what we're talking about. Can you give us a couple tip or trick for doing that?
Oh, sure. Sure. A couple of things that Google Maps did that are just awesome. You mentioned the sliding, the scrolling, some people call them sliding maps, where you can drag and drop across the map basically forever. You drag across and it just scrolls smoothly.
Mm-hmm.
That's not something that we had before in cartographic terms and in maps. It's, you know, when you have a desktop mapping system, the scroll bars work quickly enough that you don't realize it. But now, personally, when I go to a website and I'm not able to drag an image or a map or anything like that, it's sort of frustrating. It seems like it should scroll that way.
Right.
The bar has been raised sort of, maybe it's the reverse of the fear, uncertainty, doubt way that, you know, the old monopolists used to disable their competitors. In this case, Google actually made something that, you know, negates the value of everything else that's out there.
Now, or gives people hints on how to do it better.
Yeah,
I mean,
the other thing that
Yahoo's done this.
That's just awesome is is the single search bar. You don't have to do, like with MapQuest, enter an address part, the street part, the state part, the city part, the zip part, and, you know, tab through all these fields. No, you just type what you want. And it doesn't have to be anything that you're used to typing in a map. For example, you can type in Google Maps SFO, and boom, the map of San Francisco International Airport pops up. You can put a zip code in.
I read in the book that you can put an IP address in.
I'm not even going to say that, because I was about to say that, oh, no, you can't. But I had a table in the book of things that you can and can't do, and I wrote that table. I spent an evening just trying every way of representing location that I could think of, and wrote up this very nice table of what didn't work. And then in our tech review process, someone said, oh, no, this works. What are you thinking of?
They're changing it all the time is basically what happened, right?
They are. Yeah.
Well, one of the things that I thought was a great little trick, I mean, you were talking about one search bar. It used to be that when I was doing maps to get someplace, I'd put in the address I was going to, and then somewhere on the page after that loaded, I'd click, oh, to this address to get instructions, and then you put in your other address. And a great little trick on Google Maps is you can just put in the address and then write the word to, and then put the other address in and hit enter, and it will just map for you with the path and instructions on how to do that right there for you. So it's kind of a short shortcut in that regard.
And what's beautiful there is you can, when I'm going to San Francisco from my house, I know how to get to the freeway. Mm-hmm. I don't need to put my whole address in order to get that. So I'll do things like say, oh, no, I want to go from my zip code, 95472-2, a street address. And that works fine. It works beautifully. We actually have a hack in the book where, it's kind of a command line, uses Perl sort of thing, but you can type on the command line, take me, space, address, space, to, space, address, or zip code, or airport code, or whatever, space, to, another one, and it will give you the directions from one place to another, to another, to another. So you can do a multi-segment trip.
So this gets into some of your hacks, and also Drew just mentioned one which we really like. It's a hack that somebody else had made using the platform of Google Maps. And what they do is they grab some data about IP locations and then use the Google Map interface on their page. And so you put in an IP address, and it tries to give you a graphical representation of where that website is. Or you put in a domain name, for example, geekspeak.org. Can you tell me a little bit about that hack and how it works? So what are the babies you use?
Yeah, well, okay, so Skylar wrote that one up, and he also wrote code to do traceroute on your Google Maps, which is effectively works the same. A traceroute's just a series of IP addresses, and so it'll show your packets pinging across the network. Now, IP geolocation's not perfect, and it's also, in terms of privacy and freedom and all kinds of things, I'm not 100% sure we want to be encouraging it as cool as it is. Because if you have IP geolocation, you can do all those things like, saying this website's not viewable where you are.
Oh, right.
And I don't necessarily want to support that as sort of a legitimate, pursuit of the distribution of knowledge. But it is still cool to be able to say, oh, this website is in Fremont.
Right. Yeah. I think it's a pretty cool feature. I like also the traceroute thing. In traceroute, basically, the way the net works, you send packets of information across, and those packets all have a live life. So they say, don't hop this too many times through routers. And with traceroute, the little application that basically sets that up so that you can get a response from every hop that goes through, and therefore you can find out how you get data from a website server. And the way the net works is really quite complex. And when you see that kind of graphically done, it's kind of neat. You'll see it hop around to Chicago and then back over, even just to get to a place that's over the hill. It's kind of a trip to see that. So I love that hack. And again, that's in the book.
It is wonderful. It's that idea. It's kind of like you're sending a dozen postcards out, and on each one you're telling the postman, only take this to the next mail station, only take this to the next step, and then tell me how far it got.
And seeing that mapped out with your hack on a rough representation of the Earth is really fun. GeekSpeak is proudly sponsored by Business with Pleasure, a full-service business center in Felton offering color printing, design, computer rentals, delivered office supplies, shipping via FedEx, UPS, DHL, and more. Details at businesswithpleasure.com. You're listening to GeekSpeak. Our phone answer and fellow web geek Rick Philman awaits your call with questions and comments. The numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can use the internet. Visit geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. Google Maps Hacks is our topic today. It's a book by O'Reilly, Tips and Tools for Geographic Searching and Remixing. We have one of the authors, Rich Gibson, on talking with us. I'm Lyle Troxell, and in the air room with me are our geeks John Tracy and Drew Meyer. This program is supported by Cruise.io, providing local and nationwide internet services, including DSL 6.0, spam filters, and virus protection. Information about Cruise.io memberships available online at cruise.io.com or by calling 459-6301. And if you feel like calling, you can call us with questions or comments on technology. I'd love it to be about geography, mapping, and the like, or Web 2.0. But if it's anything else, we'll take that as well. The phone numbers, 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can go to the internet, visit geekspeak.org, click on Contact Us. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. The geeks this morning, John Tracy, Drew Meyer, and our geek remote is, of course, the author of Google Map Hacks, Rich Gibson. Rich, I believe that Drew was going to ask a question. Drew?
Well, I'm curious about what you know about the history of Google Maps. When you go outside of the U.S. borders to the south, for example, you don't get any information.
No, you don't.
But I can go to Canada pretty easily. I can go to Europe.
You can go to Canada. You can go to Europe. You can go to Turin now.
No.
And you can get aerial photos, actually, for a lot of places where you don't have the map data. And that's all a function of how they've rolled it out. They started where they had data and then have been through this process of acquiring more and more data.
Whose data is this?
It depends. In the case of most of the United States, it comes from a company called Navtech and another company called TeleAtlas. Actually, in data in other parts of the world, too. You can look on most of the Google Maps pages, you can look at the on the bottom of the map, and it'll say, it'll have a watermark for Google, and then it'll also say, you know, copyright Navtech. So they're using this data under license.
Okay, and so that's one of the questions I had. I mean, how does this data get updated? How does it get created? And how much is Google paying for it?
Oh, God. Google's paying... I have no idea what Google's paying. I mean, clearly. I do know fairly recently the quality of the maps that they were providing via the API, that you could put a Google map on your own web page, really took a dive as they moved from more expensive data for the API to less expensive data that was not really as good. It turns out that Navtech has hundreds of people sort of rather continuously driving around the U.S. in teams with GPS-enabled vehicles, with cameras, with recorders, with computers, the whole thing, looking at basically ground truthing the world. This exit is now closed. Oh, this exit's open. This thing has moved. This thing's not there. Because it turns out that our data, of course, lies to us.
I recall, driving along in early days of mapping, and it says, take a left, and you're on an overpass going over a road. And you're like, yeah, that's not going to happen.
Yeah, no, not going to happen.
Google Maps still has, if you try to exit Zianti and go into Mount Hermon Road from...
it's not good.
Yeah, it's like 10 feet above you.
I think it's 30 feet above you. Yeah, it's definitely a problem. Well, let's start taking some calls. It might be a little bit off topic for a little bit, but we'll get there. From Santa Cruz, need to do data recovery. So, Chris, welcome to GeekSpeak. What kind of data recovery do you need to do, Chris?
Well, thank you for taking my call. Sorry it's not on Google, but I'm kind of freaking out with this. I have a Maxter, actually it's a
External hard drive.
External hard drive, USB, and I was very clever. I hooked it up so that I could save all my documents.
Perfect.
Then I had to do a recovery on my computer, and I went back to the Maxter and says, "Oh, would you like to format your little external hard drive?"
And you said no.
And I said no, and now I'm looking at how to get that information back out of that little box.
What is the interface? Is this FireWire, USB, SCSI?
It's USB.
USB. And what operating system?
I'm using Windows XP Home Edition.
And it just says the drive needs to be formatted, huh?
Yes, it happened before. And I talked to the tech people at LaCie, and they said that this can happen when the computer crashes or if it...
Yeah, you can corrupt a drive by just smiling at it wrong.
I looked at on the internet... found out that if it overheats, then it can do this, too.
The good news you've got here is that your data's on that drive. I mean, that's true.
That's good.
Because it hasn't been erased, just that the index of files has been corrupted, and that's the what the formatting does is builds an interface to look up files on the machine. So a data recovery tool is what you probably want at this point, a software solution that mounts the drive and goes through there and looks for files and tries to recreate. It's not going to be an easy solution. I don't personally have a favorite right now. Either of you guys have a favorite on the Windows environment for data recovery?
Drew? Yeah, and with storage products, often we've used drive savers, and they seem okay. This is not going to be cheap, though. How much is that data worth to you?
Oh, I just meant a software solution, not taking it to a company.
It doesn't matter. You still got to buy the software.
That's yes, true.
I've done it before, and it works like a champ. I mean, if you pay the money, I think I got some that was like $500.
Oh.
Yeah. It's extraordinary. It'll pick up stuff that's all over the drive that you never even knew you had.
Really?
So it really works. So you don't have to worry about getting it back.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, well, but it depends how valuable it is, right?
Well, what's interesting is when I did my recovery, I thought I saw something that said, your data is going to, you know, not be compromised. And the documents that I put in the shared file are there, but the documents that are just my personal things, like my music and videos and, you know, all that stuff, just doesn't seem to be on my computer anymore.
Right.
So
when you did the update, you mean?
Yeah, when I did the recovery for the computer. Mm-hmm. That's why I went to the hard drive thing. Reinstall it.
Right. Okay. So I think one of the things to do. I mean, I'm assuming someone out there has found a relatively inexpensive software application that does this. If you've got one of those, please feel free to give us a ring, 476-2800, toll free at 1-800-655-5877, and that might solve your problem right there. Or you can, of course, you can email us if you want to help out.
Well,
but let me just suggest that another way to go is just to go to a local business that can help you out with these kind of things, and they will normally have this kind of software because that's what they do a lot, and they'll recover it for you. Since you're in Santa Cruz, one of the underwriters of GeekSpeak and KUSP is Santa Cruz Electronics. John Bauer, the owner, real great guy, and I like his staff. That's one recommendation for you. There's a lot of independent people in Santa Cruz as well. And if you go to Santa Cruz Electronics, there's actually a whole bunch of cards stuck to the wall. That's probably your best resource for this area. And I would just recommend doing that because they will have the software and they'll be able to help you to some degree. And it could cost you, but probably not as much as Drew was mentioning.
The company that I used was not Drive Savers, it was OnTrack. And they have a cheapo version that lets you get 25 files back. And that might be something that's more realistic for you. Good
Thank
luck.
You. Thank you very much for the call.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right. And of course, we still do have Rich Gibson. Rich, if you'd like to participate in this answering people's calls and such, please feel free to do so. We do have some people online that are going to ask some geographic questions, so hopefully we'll help with that.
Yeah, I was listening to that question and thinking, oh, yes, the last time I had to do that was with a Norton Disk Doctor, I think like version 3.
Uh-huh. Like Windows 95 days.
No. That was like DOS 3.
So what do you do now for backing your data up? You do multiple copies or just never lose hard drives?
Well, multiple copies, and then there are also Linux and OS 10.
Uh-huh.
So I have a whole different set of problems when I lose data.
All right.
So I wanted to say something. You mentioned the Mars mission, and that we'll have a Google Mars. I wanted to say that Worldwind, which is an open source sort of equivalent to Google Earth, the three-dimensional product, actually already has data for Mars.
And what is it called again?
Worldwind.
Worldwind.arc.nasa.gov.
Yeah, and so and Adam Hill is a friend of Skyler and mine, and mentioned a little bit ago, mentioned that they have Mars data. Thank you for listening to the show.
One of the cool things Worldwind has done is they've actually taken elevation information and put it in, so you can do like fly-throughs and, you know, how big is Olympus Mons?
And it's big, isn't it?
Oh yeah, it's, you know.
So that application, is that run on multiple platforms?
I don't actually know.
I think it's
Windows.
The book is actually about Google Map Hacks, which is a web interface application that allows you to put maps on your personal website and add a whole bunch of data. It's really cool. I want to talk a little bit more about that. But Google Earth is an application that you download to your computer. It has a lot of similarities in that you don't actually download the entire map of the Earth, but it has a whole bunch of geographic information. You can also hack that and add content to it. I'm assuming a book will come out about this because it's a great little product. It allows you to manipulate the Earth like a globe and zoom into the same detail that Google Map has. So it's great interface for playing around with the Earth, and I've been teaching like my son geography with it. I'm going to go on to the next next call, and it's...
Can I just say that Google Earth is the most incredibly amazing, useful, free application I've ever seen. I mean, we talk about it here, but if you've never seen this thing, download it. It's worth the time and energy. You'll be flying around the coast of California, and you'll be going over the wave tops. There'll be cliffs next to you. You can see the name of the street you live on, what the slope, the angle. It's just unbelievable.
I love looking up places you've been in the past and kind of take a peek at them again. It's just, it's a fun thing to do.
It also gives you a great sense for how big the planet
the
really
scale
is.
Of where
it's
we
really
do.
Yeah. Big.
It's cool.
We got to do, I got to curate a PlanetWorks event a little bit ago, and we had Rebecca Moore come, who now actually works on the Google Earth team. But she's, I guess her, one of her big things with Google Earth was there was going to be a timber harvest plan in the Santa Cruz Mountains, and they sent out this really illegible mimeographed map, and nobody was worried because you couldn't really read it to tell where the harvest was going to be. She put that into Google Earth because you can customize it with KML, keyhole markup language, because Google Earth used to be keyhole. And you can customize that and do all kinds of great stuff. And so she put the boundaries of this timber harvest area in, overlaid them on the affected area, and you could see that, you know, like it was within 100 feet of, you know, a half dozen schools, and that, you know, the roads that were going to be used were all the...
You know,
prime roads.
It's great that you're mentioning the Santa Cruz timbering, because that actually was in my backyard and in John's backyard
and
currently before I moved. It was defeated, and I didn't know that they used Google Maps, Google Earth to make the argument. I think that's really wonderful.
Rebecca Moore,
look it up, John, so we can do that.
Yeah, Rebecca Moore was a, I don't know how big a part of it, but her system was really awesome. You could really see what was happening in a way that, you know, traditional maps don't let you do.
Yeah, that really brings in one of the hacks in the book, which I really enjoyed, which was the one where the person got a speeding ticket in Manhattan and went to court and pulled out their notebook and connected wirelessly to Google Maps and showed the judge that the police officer was mistaken because the street really wasn't a one-way, it was a two-way.
Yes, I love that.
It's amazing. So there you go, power in action, right?
It's wonderful. All right, we're going to jump to another call in Santa Cruz. Welcome, Fred, to Geek Speak.
Hello.
Hi. What's up, Fred?
Yes, I've got a computer. I'm planning to buy a new computer, and I want to know what you would recommend to transfer the, both the data and the programs from the old computer to the new one.
Microsoft has a... What operating system? I'm sorry. Let me get a little more questions here. Which OS do you have today?
Pardon?
What OS do you have today?
Windows XP.
Excellent. So, and your new machine is going to be a Windows box as well, right?
Yes.
So Windows XP has built into it a file and settings transfer wizard, which you can look up in the help, and it's designed to do exactly that. It'll package up all your cookies for your browsing sessions. It'll package up all your passwords. It'll package up everything in My Documents and all the non-system files that you want to transfer over and automatically do it for you.
How do the computers talk to each other, Drew, in this situation?
You can copy it onto a disk, or if you're on a network, you can go from one to the other, I think.
Okay, so you probably want to be on a network.
Well, that would be best, solution. But you don't have to.
Good luck on that.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks
very
for
much.
The call. We're going to go right to Santa Cruz. And, Ted, you've got a question that is related to Google Maps, huh?
Yes. Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
I don't know if you remember, about a month ago, NPR had a story about how inaccurate the data is in Google Maps and MapQuest and all of those. And you folks were talking about it just a few minutes ago. So not so much a question as an idea. I was thinking... as you were speaking about the ground truthing, wouldn't it be great if somebody set up a maps wiki where everybody could input their corrections to the inaccurate data? And then if there were some way to corroborate that the corrections were themselves accurate, they could be added to the database.
So, Rich,
interesting idea.
Rich, you know anything about wikis? What do you think about that idea?
Sure. Actually, openstreetmap.org is a project to do... basically exactly that. It's a free editable map of the whole world. Here's the thing. We are blessed in the U.S. with free geographic data. And we have this tradition of the USGS releases data. You know, data that's created by public agencies, with few exceptions, is free of copyright and all sorts of things. They don't have that in Europe. In fact, they're in the midst of codifying with something called the Inspire Directive, a draconian state ownership of geodata that basically is going to destroy sort of everything I feel good about. But the OpenStreetMap project is an effort to collect geodata from individual users. So, for example, in England, you can get the most amazing maps from the Ordnance Survey, except you can't do anything with it. You can't remix that data. You can't repurpose it. You can't put an ordnance survey map on your page showing, you know, where you went on holiday. You can't do any of the things that we take for granted here. But so the OpenStreetMap project makes it essential in places where you don't have free data. And that metaphor, the way that they're working on doing user submissions, doing user corrections, and basically what's called collaborative cartography, is it's great. And, you know, Skylar and I and Joe Walsh, our other co-author on that one, we talked about that a bit in our previous book, Mapping Hacks, which was less focused on Google Maps, of course, because Google Maps hadn't come out until we were in our final production process. But, yeah, basically, OpenStreetMap is a wiki.
Okay, so, Ted, cool. There you go. It is happening. And there's also this other thing that if you're interested in adding data that's kind of personal to what you do, like adding it as a collective is kind of troublesome, you can add that information, save that information, and just make sure you make a note about it, and then Google indexing, Yahoo indexing will find that web page, and people can look at your data that you've added. So it wouldn't all be in the same interface, but that's one thought. So, Ted, you got a second question for us.
I do, yeah. This one's been bugging me for a while, totally unrelated to geography, except maybe within your Windows system. Drive letter assignments. I actually also have a USB Maxter external hard drive, like a previous caller.
Okay.
Sometimes when I plug it in, I'll hear the little beep, the little green arrow show up that the computer recognizes a USB device, but it doesn't show up in my computer. It hasn't been signed. When I go to disconnect it, it's listed as a Maxter, it's listed as generic drive, but no letter.
Doesn't get a drive letter, but you can still see it?
Well, I don't see it in my computer. I see it in the USB, you know, the safely disconnect or safely remove USB.
And then what do you do?
Well, I can disconnect it and I can reconnect it, but I can never access it.
It never gets past that point.
Right.
Do you restart the computer and it gets fixed?
Pardon?
Do you restart the computer and it gets fixed, or was it just
Well, in the case of my Maxter, I have not been able to see it at all in several weeks. Now, the same thing happens with a plug-in flash drive sometimes, and I also have a one of these multi-card readers, so when I pop a card in from a digital camera, sometimes it'll come up with a letter, and sometimes it'll come up, but no letter.
It's also USB, then?
Okay, yeah. Let's see if we got any kind of ideas on what's going on here.
Well, at first I was thinking maybe you needed to visit Maxtor's site and get some new software for your box as part of the driver that came with it, but that was a long shot, and then your other symptoms don't fit with that. So I would guess, do you have more than one USB port on the machine?
Yes.
Are you using different ones?
Yeah, I've tried a couple different ones.
And they're all behaving the same way?
Right.
Well, that kind of shoots my theory of having a bad port down.
Yeah, no, it seems to be a Windows issue. And as I say, well, in the case of the Maxter, it's been consistent. I have not been able to access it for a while. In the case of the cards, it's intermittent. Sometimes it gets a letter, and sometimes it doesn't.
I have a really simple solution for you.
Okay.
You can buy a new computer.
Say buy a Mac.
Buy a Mac.
I'm not going to say buy a Mac, no. I'm going to say buy a computer, another computer, but, of course, that's a really lame...
Have you tried it on a friend's machine?
Yeah, well, I've actually, this is, my home computer is several years old. It's Windows 2000. At work, I have a newer machine that's XP Pro.
Is it working at work?
No, the same thing is happening. I haven't brought the Maxter in.
What if it's the USB port on the drive itself? Yeah. Or you've been swapping cables out?
Yeah, I've tried.
Sometimes when a USB mounting fails, other peripherals will be affected in USB. So it could be this drive is really problematic. You put this drive in, and then everything else gets messed up on your USB, and that's why you're seeing the card reader not happen.
Try uninstalling all of the USB devices that you have, reboot the machine, and then put them back on one at a time.
But I think it's probably that drive has problems.
The
Maxtor. Now, I'm going to say that I've cracked open external hard drives before and resoldered the connectors on. Sometimes they're loose.
That's a long shot.
It's a long shot. Okay, thank you very much for the call. We're gonna go on to other ones, and
good
I appreciate
luck.
It.
Okay, thank you, Mike.
Bye-bye. All right, from Santa Cruz, a question on topic. From Sheila, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi,
Sheila. What's your question?
Internationally, the Google Earth seems to be a lot less data, and just specifically, I went looking around Rio de Janeiro, and it didn't recognize a lot of major places. I'm just wondering, is it just mostly in this country that it's very, very detailed? And are we hopeful to see it get a little better? I mean, as I mentioned to the person who took the call, It didn't recognize Copacabana, Ipanema.
Rich, you got some answers to that? What's going on?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of this is actually related to that prior point about government ownership of geodata. You know, for years, and originally mapping was a military pursuit, and so nations keep a close lock on their mapping data, or they have. You know, even now, Pakistan and other countries too is complaining about Google Maps, the imagery. You know, it shows their submarine bases or their whatever.
In fact, if you look at Baghdad, it's really crystal clear.
Yeah.
If you look at Pearl Harbor, it's really, you can see the actual harbor itself, but the military base is very obscure. In fact, if you look up any military base on Google Maps, it's really obscure.
You look up them. I mean, like, some things really are. Like, you can look at the White House, and it's very detailed, except for the roofs.
Mm-hmm.
The roofs have been obscured. The U.S. Capitol, though, is completely obscured by that. But anyway, so national mapping agencies have basically pitched the fear thing that we can't let people have our data because if they know where we are, they're going to, you know, bad actors are going to be bad.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and then there's also the thing that there's probably just the inertia that releasing data to a bunch of geek hackers is a pain in the ass. So, I'm sorry. So, why do it? And it's also the world's a big place. It takes a lot of effort to do that. So, you know, Google, I've heard on more than once from, you know, Google guys that they're working to extend the data, that's their big thing, you know, with both Google Earth and Google Maps. And it's not perfect now.
Right. Well,
not even close.
Yeah, and so a lot of it is that the we have a great open, if you will, data information in the United States on mapping. Other countries don't have so much open information.
Yeah,
and that's one of the major problems with map information being not so good in other places. I get that. I thank you. I want to thank Sheila very much for your call.
Thank you.
It takes us right into a Google, in your book, in hack number 43, don't believe everything you read on a map.
Yes, I love that one.
That's fantastic. Where particularly the Microsoft Apple one. You want to tell us about that?
Sure. So at that point, it's no longer true, but at that point, if you went to, let's say, if you looked at one infinity loop on Google Maps, you saw the Apple campus.
Which is the headquarter of Apple campus.
Right.
In Cupertino, California.
Yeah, okay. Indeed. And if you did the same thing on Microsoft's product, it looked like a bombed-out rubble site. Basically, it was still a construction site. An old shopping center, an old supermarket or something is still shown there. And they had to go fairly far back to get that imagery. I mean, I don't want to talk too much smack about Microsoft. But
do you think Microsoft did that intentionally to remove one of its competitors from
the
Earth?
That's the question, isn't it? I mean, the mapping data was available to everybody, but somehow they got two different slices in their databases.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that in that whole hack, you see different examples where people made conscious choices of what they were going to select.
Uh-huh.
Okay, in the imagery. Like, if you look at the Black Rock Desert in Google Maps, lo and behold, there's Burning Man shown from 2003
right.
During the setup. That was a choice someone made. And if you look at Candlestick Park, whatever it's called these days, it's during a game day. The parking lot's full. There it is. If you look at 3Com Park or whatever, it's completely empty. It's a ghost.
So there's definitely some manipulation of the data, even if it's subtle.
Well, is it manipulation or is it... I guess I talked about that in the hack, that it doesn't mean it's necessarily wrong. Okay, people had to make choices, and they might as well make the interesting choice. But still, I think it's enough. I think my quote is, reality is a commodity like any other. And so you have to be careful when you look at mediated commodities.
The book is Google Map Hacks by O'Reilly, Tips and Tools for Geographic Searching and Remixing, Ability to Use the Data and Web Technologies on Your Own Site. There's some great potential here for extending information you want to share with people, geographic information. And the book, like all the hacks books from Google, is just a listing of over and over just multiple things you can do that is cool with this technology. So I don't know how many hacks are in this book, but that hack that we were just talking about, which number is that, Drew?
Number 43.
Number 43 talks about, and I guess it's a hack, but it's also some information, about how the data might not be reality and what reality is with regard to geography. Maps have always been trying to represent reality to some degree, and the level of that reality is based on the people that make the maps and what they choose to do, and it's...
Can I interrupt you there?
Please.
You know, I have this thing that maps reflect reality, but they also create reality in a very literal sense. We have the senses that we have of the places that we see on maps because of choices that map makers made. Everything from, you know, the whole greenlining phenomena where, you know, whole neighborhoods are you know, redlined, I guess, you know, off that they don't matter, to what we choose to emphasize on our maps, the colors that we choose to, you know, put our parks in versus our, you know, toxic waste dumps. All of these choices create, quite literally, our perception of reality. So it's not just that, you know, oh, there's this reflection of reality.
We're going to go ahead and go to one more question. I think this is going to be the last one we're going to take. It's from Felton. Karen, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hello.
Hi, Karen. What's your question?
Hello. I have gone onto Google Maps, and I have to say that if I hadn't been on the phone with my brother-in-law at the time, I never would have made it through the whole system. Where can computer dodos like me get good instructions on how to navigate through Google Maps?
Okay, I think I'm going to take your question off air because your phone's really noisy. We will address that. Sounds great. So what do you think? Karen's question is basically, how does somebody go up that's not familiar with web applications necessarily and start using Google Maps? Is your book the right solution for them?
It's a fine solution. I mean, I hate pitching things. So let's go with first what she can do, you know, to empower herself. You go to maps.google.com, and it has a little help screen. And it's good. I, you know, had some effort at reading that and then paraphrasing it and exploring ways that, you know, to extend their first useful help screen.
There's a nice link on the very front page. It says take a tour. You're exactly right.
I mean, it's beautiful there. The next thing is, you know, the first section of our book is all about things that anyone can do who can use a web browser. And then we tried really hard to have even the technical hacks start out with, here's something cool that anyone can read, and then here's how you can do it if you're technically inclined, how you can do it on your own map. And let me actually, we didn't touch on this. This is something that's vital about Google Maps, is they've offered an open API. Now, what that means to most people maybe isn't that much, but it means that if you know how to write even a little bit of HTML, and pretty much just if you can cut and paste HTML, you can put a Google Map on your own web page with, you know, locations of your house, your events, things that you want to do. And that's pretty amazing. You know, until Google did that, to put a map on your own page was really hard, really expensive if you did it commercially. You couldn't do MapQuest. MapQuest wouldn't even allow you to have a link to one of their maps that opened in a new window.
Right. And your book definitely covers all about that, kind of adding and remixing this data.
Yeah, absolutely.
The book is called Google Map Hacks, Tips and Tools for Geographic Searching and Remixing, author Rich Gibson and Skylar Earle, with a foreword from creators of Google Maps themselves. Rich Gibson is a Perl database developer, a Perl programmer and database programmer in Santa Rosa. He's got tons of experience with all things geographic online, and I want to thank you very much for joining us today on Geek Speak.
Thank you very much.
The geeks this morning were John Tracy and Drew Meyer. In answering the phones, of course, was Rick Philman, as he is every week. Thank you very much for your participation in Geek Speak. And thank you for listening to Geek Speak. To those of you that called in, thanks for making Geek Speak what it is. Without you, it'd just be us geeking out. And who wants to listen to that? Geek Speak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used by permission. This program is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts, as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 SoCal Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. Next week, we'll be back, as we are every week, here with helping with your questions, of comments, and technology, filling you on the geek news. Next week, we've got the author, Chris Kohler, author of Retro Gaming Hacks, another book by O'Reilly. And I guess next week, we'll be giving out a lot of books. We'll give out two Google Map Hacks books. We'll be giving out some Retro Gaming Hacks. And, of course, to round up our three shows on O'Reilly books, we'll also be giving out some T-shirts. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP Santa Cruz, KBH San Otto, on the web at kosp.org for KOSP and Geek Speak. I'm Lyle Troxell.